Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harrah's. Brought to you by Poker Stars and the Poker Players Alliance.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner.
You got it.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Jackpot.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Coming up on the show today, 3 weeks into his reign as the champion of the world of poker, the 2010 main event winner, Jonathan Duhamel, returns to the final table. Hello, I am Paul Harrah, sitting in the feature table in the poker room at Harrah's St. Louis, while my partner Dennis Phillips is back out in Las Vegas. Hello, Dennis. How are you? How was your Thanksgiving?
Actually, pretty good. Nice, pleasant time, and just kind of relaxed for a couple of days.
Nice.
Didn't eat too much, even.
Oh, I ate way too much. Thanksgiving's my favorite holiday. Any holiday involving a fork is a good holiday for me.
All right.
So before we get into anything else, I want to start the show today by congratulating a guy who we've gotten to know over the last couple of years, Gavin Smith, whose girlfriend Casey gave birth to a baby boy a couple of weeks ago. And we didn't have a chance to talk about it on last week's show because we were so caught up in our trip to Indiana for the Hollywood Casino. But everybody's doing well, happy and healthy, and congratulations to Gavin and Casey. He was really looking forward to being a dad when we talked to him this summer after he won that bracelet, wasn't he?
Absolutely was. We had the bracelet. We talked to him after that. I was up in Calgary, played the Canadian Heads Up that he was also in, and she was up there with him, and I got to meet and talk to her a little bit. A couple of years ago, with his reputation and the way Gavin was, you wonder, settling down, becoming a father, wow. But I'll tell you, he was so excited about it. I think he's going to dot on that kid. I think he will bust his tail to become a good father for that kid.
Yeah, I think so, too. And as he told us then, he does not want his child to become a poker pro because, in his words, it's just too hard. And if you missed that show that we did with Gavin this summer, you can find it on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. That's where we put up all the podcasts of our shows. And today is our 96th show, so you can find them all on there. And you can also subscribe to the show via iTunes and go back into history there and find Gavin and many of the others that we have talked to. Okay, some news here. As Dennis knows, the NAPT played a couple weeks ago out at the Bike in Los Angeles and had their bounty shootout and all the rest. I got an email from a guy by the name of Jim, who listens to the show and was at the NAPT at Venetian back in February that Dennis and I both were in. And Jim said he liked the way that the NAPT at the Bike was done, where the main event didn't come at the end but came before some of the other events, because he said that gave him a chance, once he busted out of the NAPT main event, to have other tournaments to play in. Now, I'd never thought about this before, but if you think about the way the World Series of Poker runs, where the main event is event 57, and after that's done, there's the 119-day break before the November 9, and you're done. So if you only go out there to play in the main event, if you bust out on day 1A, there's no other event for you to play in, although there are some deep stack events going on for, a couple hundred bucks in the pavilion room at the Rio. But I don't know of any other tournament structures around the country that think to put the main event, if not first, then certainly middle of the tournament run of 10 days or 2 weeks. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, absolutely. That was the reason why we did it. If you've ever been out to the World Series and you've run deep into it, it's amazing when you hit days 4, 5, 6, you wonder where everybody went. You walk into the Amazon room, and instead of this massive amount of people and tables and that, it's all condensed down into one little corner, which is a handful of tables and a handful of spectators. And it's just wide open space everywhere. Everybody's gone home. Everybody's, gone back to their normal lives and that. When we do this at the NAPT, when that main event's going on, You have all of your friends that came out there, all the people that got knocked out. They're playing other events. They're able to watch and follow the people. Maybe somebody they played against on day one, or somebody that they've seen have some other success somewhere else. It just makes logical sense to have that going on from beginning to end and then run the other tournaments simultaneously. So you have something to do. You can follow the final table. You're followed down to the final table. Everything like that. It's a nice structure, and I like it.
Do you like the idea of maybe making the main event the first, kind of the kickoff to a two-week run of tournaments?
It's possible, but I don't know whether you really want it the first event. You get people down there, you get them acclimated, you run a few satellites, some other things into the main event for those first few days,
yeah.
And then you go with the main event.
Yeah, I think
so. Probably not the first one.
No, but I think the satellites is a perfect argument for why you don't want to put it first. You know, if you're going to be running, say, 2 weeks, for instance, when the World Series of Poker Circuit event comes back here on March 31st next
uh-huh.
year, just 4 months away, as a matter of fact, you know, they will have satellites running all day, every day. And if the main event, the $1,650 main event, were to take place, not necessarily at the, you know, the third or fourth day of the event, but maybe 7 or 8 days into that, I think people who came to town might stick around a little bit longer to continue to play, A, some of the events that are going on afterwards, B, some of the other megas and other things that are going on, and see, have more time to sit down and play in the cash games because there'll be so many players around.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, it does make a difference. If your main event for whatever term you're talking about is only a two-day event, it's not that big of a difference maybe. But if you've got a 3, 4, 5-day event and you could be running these others during that, I don't think you need to schedule that for the last event. I think you need to bump it up.
Yep, I agree. I don't know if Jack Effel and the people at the World Series of Poker or other tournament directors like Matt Savage have considered doing that, but maybe the NAPT set a precedent with that out in Los Angeles. Okay, a follow-up about Peter Eastgate's bracelet, which we told you was going to be auctioned off on eBay as a fundraiser for UNICEF. Peter says he doesn't wear jewelry. It doesn't mean anything to him. He owns the title, but he's out of the world of poker, and he thought, let this go to do some good. He had started it with a reserve price of $16,000, and Dennis and I both thought that if this thing went for more than 20 or 25, we'd be surprised. Did you see the final total, Dennis?
I did, actually, and I think if you go back, I think I projected it at 40,000, I thought it would be.
Okay. You were only off by 100.
Yeah, just a little off. But 100? I think at 40,000, I would have been interested in it. But at 140,000, I'm just glad for UNICEF.
$147,500. like you said, good for UNICEF, and you know, good for Peter for raising money for a terrific cause. Tony G, who had made lots of noise about wanting to get this thing so he could turn it into a bracelet for his dog, apparently dropped out of the bidding at $125,000. We do not know who the person is who was the high bidder. They've done it anonymously. And who knows whether that thing reappears. You know, some sports memorabilia, and I know you have some, that you've collected with your relationship with Albert Pujols over the last couple of years and others that you've also bought on the open market. Some sports memorabilia you get for personal reasons because it means something to you because you add a game or whatever. Others you buy because you're hoping you can hold it as an investment and in a couple of years you can resell it. Do you think somebody can resell Peter Eastgate's bracelet for more than $147,000?
I doubt it, to be honest. You never know what's going to happen, but you got to realize what a rare commodity these are. When was the last time you saw one of these come up and available from anybody?
Well, there's not a main event bracelet, but there is another World Series of Poker bracelet that's on eBay right now. Eskimo Clark won one for Raz in 1999. I checked this morning. It was a little over $4,000.
Yeah.
That's just a matter of somebody wanting to have a bracelet, right?
Right, that's a big difference.
Yeah.
This is a main event bracelet. This is a one-of-a-kind type thing. There was only one given out that entire year. There's only one given out every year. There's only been 40 given out altogether. And these things are, I mean, I don't remember what it was. There's 200 or 300 diamonds on this thing. I mean, it was just actually a little overboard, to be honest about it.
Yeah.
But still, it is unique. It is. It would be like somebody having a if they handled the Stanley Cup out every year. You know, there would only be a few of them around there, and they would be very valuable, each individual one.
Also, I went onto eBay, and I looked at the Eskimo Clark bracelet, and this is nothing against him. But the 1999 World Series of Poker non-main event bracelets, not impressive at all. I'm telling you, you look at it and you think to yourself, Cracker Jacks.
No. I think these things were gold. I mean, I think there was some value into it. Granted, nowhere near what they are for the main events and for what they've done now. But a little better than Cracker Jacks.
Okay. Also in the news this week, you remember back in August, we talked about a guy in New Mexico named Samuel McMaster, who defrauded a whole bunch of people of their life savings. He was a kind of a Bernie Madoff kind of guy who had taken money and said he was going to invest it and never did. He was being prosecuted, and I guess he was in front of a judge. And as we told you this summer, the judge said, if you can pay back the people, the 20 people you ripped off, then we'll lessen the charges against you. And he owed something like $444,000. And he said to the judge, Your Honor, I'm a professional gambler. I would like to be able to travel to play poker tournaments to be able to win this money to cover it, even though in his life he had never won anything for more than, say, $5,000. That was in August, and the judge actually said, okay. Well, it turns out he was back in court yesterday. According to KRQE Television, the only money he's made was cashing at a deep stack event at the Venetian for $1,400. And he went back and admitted to the judge, I never have been, nor will I ever be, a professional gambler. And and there's a lesson for anybody who thinks, I'm going to make it in the world of poker.
It's not quite as easy as it seems from the outside.
Particularly when every dollar you win is going to be going to somebody else. What kind of incentive are you going to... Well, I guess the incentive is, I'll stay out of prison.
I was about to say, he had a pretty good incentive. He really doesn't want to go there and visit Bubba.
No, he doesn't. So, according to the court, he has yet to make any payments to any of his victims, so now he's facing 12 years in the slammer.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah.
Ouch. That's a bad beat.
Yeah. TV poker, the big game, is back. As we've mentioned before, it's not televised here in St. Louis, but it is on some Fox stations around the country, and I watch it on PokerStars.tv, the website. This week, PokerStars is represented by Joe Catta and David Williams. Phil Locke is there. A businessman named Bill Perkins is there. The loose cannon is a guy named David Fishman, who plays just like all the other loose cannons. Very, very scared on episode one last night. And Phil Hellmuth, also at the table, which brings us to a topic I want to address with you, which is that Phil Hellmuth was seen at both the NAPT and at a recent Poker After Dark taping not wearing the Ultimate Bet logos. Phil has been arguably the face of UB Poker. Annie Duke and Phil have been the ones who have been with them the longest and are out there the most, but Phil gets so much TV time that he is really the promotional vehicle for UB. So they haven't signed him to a new deal. And I wonder why or what's up. What do you think?
Well, remember, this is Phil. Now, I don't know anything about his contract. Don't know whether we just ran out of patches or if he is out of contract or whatever.
Oh, no, there's no way he just ran out of patches. This is a guy. Is there anybody in poker who knows more about self-promotion than Phil Hellmuth? Saying he ran out of patches would be like you forgetting to breathe.
All right. That's probably a very small percentage if I was putting a prop bet up there. But Phil being Phil, likes to be the center of attention, likes to be the main vehicle, likes to be the one, has huge media attraction. The guys love to put a mic underneath him because they know they're going to get something. They always follow him on the table because there's always interaction. I mean, he's good for TV. He's good for poker in that way. Like or dislike Phil doesn't make any difference. He can be very good for TV poker. That's a given.
Yep.
That being said, I don't know what Phil's demands would be. If you listen to him, he's obviously the best poker player that's ever lived on this planet.
Yeah.
Just ask him. He'll tell you that. So, that makes it very simple then. I don't know what his contract status is. Don't know how he's signing there. If he's looking to test the market, shall we say, if he's looking to see what comes out of this lame duck session in Washington and you know, if the playing field is actually leveled here in the U.S. and it opens up, I don't know. What would Phil Hellmuth be worth on the open market? I actually think perhaps Now, boy, I'm just guessing on this. I don't know anything facts-wise. I don't know that he would be a great fit for the two big ones, for the Poker Stars and the Full Tilt. Obviously, either one of them could use him. Obviously, he'd be an attraction. But he's used to being the only attraction in the UB. He's used to being the guy, the go-to, the everything. You go over to Full Tilt and you look at everybody from a Phil Ivey to a Howard Lederer to a Chris Ferguson to whatever. You go to Poker Stars and you look at Daniel, and then you look at all of the world champions that are up there, from a Hashem and a Ringer and a Moneymaker. I mean, he's not going to be the only, you know, ship at the dock. That's all there is to it.
Yep.
He might fit in very, very well with one of these companies that may come online and start going when this law changes. I don't know. I could see maybe somebody reaching out to him for that.
Well, let me ask you about the two big sites. Before we talk about potential others, I got to ask you about your comments about Stars and Full Tilt. And let's talk about Stars, too, because you've been affiliated with them for a couple of years. Stars doesn't have any guys who I would consider to be loudmouths, guys who have made their reputation by being obnoxious at the table or being egomaniacs. There are a couple of those guys with Full Tilt. You know, Mike the Mouth Matisau is over there, and a couple of other guys. But even then, neither of those guys have made it all about them. I think Howard and the other people who set up Full Tilt, when they've hired Red Pros, have been very careful about who they've chosen and who they want to be the face of their brand. Do you think that history has anything to do with his being Helmuth's viability as a sponsored player for either of those two sites?
Well, I think they're the only two sites that his value, I don't want to say it wouldn't be minimal, but it wouldn't be as big an impact as it would be on a lot of other places. For him to come to either of those sites, it could be a positive. Yeah, there can be some good PR. He can draw some attention and all this other stuff. But I don't think he's a great fit for him, and I don't think either site really needs him. I have to admit that.
Okay, well, then let's talk about other possibilities. You talked about, you know, what happens if online poker does get licensed and regulated. There's only a week left in the lame duck session, and I don't think it's going to happen. And then with the Republicans in the House, when Spencer Baucus gets in charge of the House Financial Services Committee, you got 2 years of this being dead in the water. But even if it were to happen, is Phil the kind of guy who would be sitting on the sidelines waiting to see, would, for instance, this organization that we represent on this show, Harrah's, they've got their WSOP brand. They've got it up as an online poker site in Europe. And, of course, also in Europe, you've got sites like Party Poker, Party Gaming, very, very popular over there. They do not operate within the U.S., but they do operate in other parts of the world. Could Helmuth, even if the thing doesn't pass Congress, could Helmuth go with them and be the big dog, the big face of those?
He absolutely could be. If he's looking for a site where he's going to be the mainstay, the man, the one that they all count on, it would have to be one of those sites, and he could definitely be that. You got to like or dislike Phil doesn't make any difference. He is still a media draw. He still attracts attention. He still will have the cameras on him. So, you know, that being the case, if you were a new company just opening its doors and you want some recognition and you want some people following you and you want some people to see your signage, well, you slap them on Phil. They'll see him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, that brings me to the last question. Media exposure. As a spokesperson for UB, he has been welcomed on shows sponsored by Stars and Full Tilt. He's allowed to go on The Big Game, which is a PokerStars-sponsored TV show. He's allowed to go on Poker After Dark, which is a Full Tilt-sponsored TV show. If he signed with either of those sites, would that cut down on his potential to do TV?
It actually could, because there is a little bit of, people that kind of guard their own TV shows and that. I don't know. Potentially it could. I still think everybody will want Phil on their show. Doesn't make any difference what company is sponsoring it or whatever. Everybody likes to have Phil on the show.
Yep.
But it potentially could limit some of his.
Well, I know some high-stakes cash game TV players who really want to have Phil continue to be on those shows. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be joined by the 2010 main event champion, Jonathan Duhamel, who, like Dennis was mentioning a moment ago, is one of the six guys out of the last eight to win the main event and wear the Poker Stars patch, just like you do, Dennis.
Oh, absolutely. Everything is going on with Poker Stars. This is just awesome. I'm telling you what, they've got so many different things going on there and so many different ways that you can, find ways to play poker. If you want to go to Australian Play, go to PokerStars.net, and you can learn, find a way to play and get down there, and they'll pay it. All you have to do is win the tournament. They have a tremendous – they just sent me another thing now. They have what they're calling a fish and chips event down at the PCA, down in the Bahamas here in January, where they're going to combine fishing and poker into a tournament. Yeah. So I think one-third of the points counted to the fishing and two-thirds with the poker tournament. I know I've been invited to go down there, but so they invited a group of people, assuming a lot of us wouldn't. I think we all accepted. So they're going to have to limit it. I don't know who's going to end up being down there with a fishing pole, but I'd love to be one of them. And just things like that. All you got to do is go to PokerStars.net, download the software. It's the best in the world. It's a 24/7 site. It's a great place to learn. You can play against, again, these other six different champions. Come on down there, guys. It's so much fun, and there's so much reward. If you want to play poker, go to PokerStars.net.
I like the idea that two events in which being the fish is not a good idea. He's Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. We're back with Jonathan Duhamel in a moment on the final table from Harris, St. Louis on 590 of the Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcast via iTunes and on theshipleader.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show from Harris, St. Louis. I'm Paul Harris, sitting in the feature table here at Harris in the poker room, while my partner Dennis Phillips is in Las Vegas. That music is by Dropkick Murphys, who, that song right there called I'm Shipping Up to Boston was the song that Jonathan Duhamel listened to over and over again to get himself psyched up for the final table of this year's World Series of Poker main event. It must have worked because at the end, he walked away with all the chips. He actually sat down as the chip leader, as the first guy since Jamie Gold to start the final table as the chip leader and then end it with all the chips in front of him and a check for nearly $9 million. We talked to him a couple of months ago during the big layoff between the main event and the November 9, and he said at the time, when it's all over, guys, I'll come back, win or lose. I bet you're happier to say it's while you won, John. Welcome back to the show.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Very happy to be on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. How has the media tour been? I know that we held off on having you on 2 weeks ago and last week because I know that you were going crazy. Do you have any idea how many interviews you've done in the last 3 weeks?
Oh, boy, I have no idea. It's over a couple hundred, that's for sure. I've had a couple of people just trying to fix my schedule so that I can do as much as possible. So I've done a lot, but, you know, it's all good. I can't complain at all, so it's a good feeling right now.
Are you enjoying being the poker ambassador?
Yes, I do. I do. It's kind of a new challenge for me. Of course, I'm not used to do that, but, you know, I take that role very seriously, so I want to go like 100% on that. I want to do my best. As I said, it's a new challenge, so I'll just try to be as best as I can with that.
Well, I know that you're doing a pretty good job. I actually think you're over 300 interviews that you've done, in fact.
Wow.
Yeah, it's possible.
But I really appreciate you trying to be an ambassador and trying to help this game that we all love to play so much. There was actually some question when it came down to heads up as to who would be the better ambassador between you and Reisner. Actually, I think you both could do a very, very good job. Your thoughts right now on poker and where it's going to go and what we can do maybe to improve the game or promote the game? Any idea of what you're going to try and promote the next year?
Well, I don't know. For me, it's kind of just, remember people that, you know, this is just a fun game that we love playing. You know, at the beginning, it's just we all learned that game and that we play that game with friends and stuff like that. So it's just a very fun thing to do. So, you know, remember to the people that, you know, just a cool thing to do in a way. And I don't get, you know, sometimes too overexcited with that and just, you know, have fun with it. Play sometimes because it's cool to play and enjoy it.
John, By the way, John, was the biggest thing to happen in Montreal in the last 3 weeks until the Montreal Alouettes won the Grey Cup for the second year in a row, back-to-back repeat. So congratulations to the city of Montreal for that as well. But I do have a sports question for you. I know that you have been a lifelong Montreal Canadiens fan, and the last time they won the Stanley Cup, you were 6 years old.
Yes. But I do remember it, though. I do remember it.
Would you give up your bracelet for a cup for the Canadiens?
Don't ask me that question. This is like the toughest question on earth. Oh, boy. You know that, you know, all my life I've played hockey, and all my life I wanted to win the Stanley Cup, you know, playing in the NHL and win the Stanley Cup. You know, it has been my dream since, I don't know, I'm 4 or 5 years old. So it's a really, really tough question. But, you know, I've played so much poker over the past few years that for me, just like I've won it, just like I've won the Stanley Cup, so... It's I don't know. It's like the best feeling ever for me. I guess winning both would be the best, of course. But you can have everything.
Yeah.
So
I'm
just the happiest guy on the world right now with my bracelet.
Well, I could see you smiling again, though. If you can actually get to drop the puck in one of those games, wouldn't that be awesome?
Of course, yes. Of course, it would be. And I know they're going to do something at Bell Center because you know I'm going to be giving $100,000 to the Montreal Canadian Child Foundation. So they should do something about that pretty soon. I don't know what date exactly, but you know, because of that, and also I think because of the fact that all my supporters had the Montreal Canadian Abs jersey on them when I won the bracelet, I think they're pretty happy about that, and it has made, you know, a lot of people from Montreal very proud of that, I think.
Yeah, John, we've been keeping an eye on what you've been posting on Twitter over the last couple of weeks, and I wanted to ask you about one specific person. A couple of times online, you have thanked somebody named Giggy, and you've mentioned that Giggy helped you get ready for the final table. Who is this mysterious Giggy, and how did he help you?
Well, Giggy is actually Jiggy, it's called.
Oh, Jiggy, I'm sorry.
Yeah, he's one of my good buddies from Quebec City. We actually played a couple of poker together a couple of years ago, but now he's become one of my very good friend of mine, and we talk strategy a lot. You know, he's a very, very good poker player, so we help each other, I think. And, you know, just before the heads up, he gave me a lot of tips, you know, a couple of things on, you know, how to approach the heads up match, you know, depending on how many big blinds and stuff you have. So it really helped me a lot. You know, that guy actually is a partner with Jason Sentai and Phil Galfond on their coaching training site, www.bluefirepoker.com. So I've personally watched all of those videos, very good ones, and I got to say, you know, they helped me a lot. And Jiggy also helped me a lot for the final table. So, you know, I got to give credit to him, a very good friend of mine and a very, very good poker player as well.
Well, excellent. What other work did you do to improve your game during that downtime, during that 119 days before you got to the final table?
Well, you got to do everything you can to, you know, just be as much prepared as you can. You know, for me, I've played a lot of, you know, I didn't play that many live poker. I played a little bit in the Poker Stars at EPT London. Then after that, I played a lot online, though. You know, there was the W Coup on Poker Stars at that time. So I played those tournaments. I play, you know, every tournament I could find online, a couple of sit-in goals also. You know, you want to be sure that your game is sharp, your game is ready. And after that, it was just about, you know, the mental part of it. Be sure you're well rested, your focus is at a good place, and you know you're mentally ready to go there. And you know you got to be sure that no matter what's gonna happen at the final table, you're mentally, you know, ready to go there and you know, play good. As I said, no matter what's happened.
You know, Dennis, what John was saying about talking with Jiggy and a couple of other friends about getting strategies down, even though he was going in to the heads-up match with Reisner, a 6-1 chip favorite, it still is good. And you've talked about this so many times, and I've used you as my sounding board when I've been playing in much smaller tournaments. You know, if I get to day two of these things and we're down to the last 27 players and I want to get to the final table, I've called you and you've been able to give me advice and help me go over some hands. That is a key thing for any real poker player to have, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Well, you need a couple of good friends in that, you know, in this thing. But, you know, a lot of mentors, I call them poker mentors, you know, there's always going to be people that's better poker players than you. So you got to talk to those people and try to get some kind of tips or, you know, just just the fact that you toss strategy all together, you know, you're all going to become better poker players. So just in a way, it just, I think it's good. And like for us, Montreal and Quebec, we're very, very close to each other. There's not that many poker players. So we know each other, all of us, and we talk strategy all the time. We travel together and all those things. And I think it's very important to, you know, you don't want to be alone when you do those tournaments. So it's very important to have a lot of good poker friends, people you can count on, and people that can give you some tips also.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. They don't have to be better players than you. They just have to understand the game, and you be able to talk intelligently with them on a nice level. Maybe, you know, an action, a reaction. How would you have played this hand? You know, they may not even have played it the same, but it's the options in on it. Maybe that would help you to put your opponent on a different hand. I agree with you about the talking.
There's no, like, perfect way to play a poker hand anyway,
oh,
so just to have different opinions on it and, you know, different approach on the game, it just can help you and give you, you know, different weapons, you know, when you come at the table and to how to approach that that table you play on.
Yeah. I noticed that also on the event right before this, event 56, you went very, very deep in that event too. A couple of questions. First of all, had you played a number of other events there at the World Series? And how did that help you mentally if you go really deep on the event and then you're ready to go into the main event?
Well, yeah, this year I played a lot. You know, last year I only played 4 events and, you know, didn't feel like I was too ready to go to the main event. It was my first one. It was a good experience. But, you know, this summer I just felt like, you know, I have to play a lot if I really want to get ready. So total I played 17 events. You know, the first 15 ones I only cashed one time. But then, you know, the one just before the main event, as you mentioned, finished 15 in this one. So it was a very good finish. Gave me a lot of confidence going into the main event. You know, I was I played a lot, so I kind of felt like I was ready. I was in the zone and focused a little bit. So I just tried to play the best I could after that. And, you know, it gave you a lot of motivation when it's come to the main event. So I was kind of very happy to make a score just before that. I think the boost there just was, I don't want to say I kind of felt invincible, but I felt very good about my game, and I was sure that if I play good, I think I'm going to make a deep run and make a good finish.
Nice confidence builder.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris at Harris St. Louis, and Jonathan Duhamel is on the phone with us. He is the 2010 Main Event World Champion. We've got to talk about a couple of the hands from your final table, and, of course, one of them is already become one of the most famous hands ever played in poker. People are calling it the Joseph Chong blow-up. Others are saying you played a perfect trap game against him. It's the one where you had queens and he had the ace seven, and it went raise, re-raise, re-raise, re-raise. Finally, he six bet shoves with the ace seven after you had min five raised. Take us through that a little bit, but before you even tell us about what was going through your mind in that hand, tell us about the history that you two had had earlier on and how much that impacted how you played against him, not just in that hand, but at the rest of the November 9 final table.
Well, I think it's very important that you mentioned the history there, because I think all of what happened during that hand was because of the history we had previously on that final table. I think we both played very, very aggressive from the very beginning. We were the two most active players at the table. We were the two ones that were, you know, raising as much on the table, tributing a lot, and you know, because of that, we were involved in a lot of hand, once against each other. So when we come to the three-handed play, both of us were still very aggressive, but the fact that John Risner was very short in chips, we kind of, for me, I kind of thought that we would just slow down a little bit and just try to, you know, steal our blinds and wait for, you know, John Risner to either, you know, bust or double up. So for me, I kind of thought, you know, we're going to just slow down a little bit. But, you know, Joseph had other things in mind. He wanted to play some, some rough poker, some very active, aggressive poker. So at some point, you know, for me, I had three bet him a lot because on the final table, I had position on him. So I kind of felt that my three bet is going to work a lot. But he had four bet me a lot of times, and almost each time I folded to his four bet. So I kind of felt I have to slow down maybe a little bit and just, you know, wait for a good spot to try to make a good five bet over his four bet, or just, you know, to call his four bet. So at that point, when that happened, he had a couple of chips that he was playing like the most aggressive when we were three-handed. So when he picked up, you know, it was A7 for him. I was blind versus blind during that hand. It's kind of normal for him to raise from the small blind with A7 there. You know, when I look at my two queens, I'm so happy about that. You know, for me, it's kind of the nuts right now because, you know, we're three-handed and he's playing so aggressive. So for me, it's just how can I get all of his stack like a pre-flop? That was like the main goal out there. So it was, I just made that normal three bet like I would do with a lot of hands. With I think of my really bad hands, I would do that. And with my very good hands, a lot of times I'm going to just call and play in position against him. But there, my hand was just too strong. So that's why I decided to raise. But then again, I had three bet him a lot. And almost every time he four bets me, I folded. So that's probably why he decided to four bet there. But then again, I was going nowhere. So maybe because of the fact that I had fold every time to his four bet, it was time for me to put off a small five bet bluff. Probably that's what he thinks. So at that point, when I decided to five bet, all of the time it's going to be a small one. It's going to be a small re-raise. You know, if I'm bluffing or if I actually have a hand, it's going to be a small five bet. So I just put that small five bet in to give him some, you know, some space to shove over. If he decided that I was bluffing most of the time, then eventually decided that I'm going to be five betting light, you know, five bet folding enough times for him to shove. So he decided to shove. Of course, I called him with my queens. I was happy. I wasn't scared about the aces or kings. Of course, he could have that hand, but I mean, at that point, I just felt like I have to take that gamble and I have to, you know, go to war with him. But thing is, I don't agree with people calling, you know, the Joseph Chung blow up or anything like that. Maybe it was a small mistake, but it's really not as bad as what most people think because, you know, I have to be folding not that often to his shoves so that it's profitable for him. So, you know, it was just one of those hands with the setup that was in. Just one with that. And, you know, I think we both played for the victory. I mean, Joseph and me would not have been happy with second place, so it was about its first place or nothing at that point. And I was just, like, fortunate to keep to put up the queens and, you know, go with it.
Well, that's very interesting. Actually, it took a lot of my ammunition away because that was a great analysis. I was looking at the percentages that everybody played. You were by far the most on the three bets. You were three betting almost 7% of the time. Joseph was second at 5% of the time doing it. But do you realize that your four bets were non-existent until you did that one? You had four bets in the first 97.
Yeah, I think I haven't four bet one time. But I folded every time Joseph four bets me, though. So probably one of the fact that he thought that I could be pulling a five bet bluff there. Because, you know, chances I would do that were there. I would put a small five-bet bluff because he had four-bet me all the time. So that's why, as I said, I don't think it's that bad of a mistake from Joseph there. It's just that I actually had a hand at that time. But, you know, he could have gone either way, I think.
That was one of the points I was going to bring out, and you very well stated it already. The other thing was, now, about 15 hands before that, you got into a contest with him again when he three-barrel bluffed you. Out of position with nothing more than the jack high, and you caught that king on the river. If you hadn't caught that king, how much of a difference would that have made, and how much, by you catching that king, do you think that made him more willing to throw in a five bet?
Well, in my mind, when that hand happened, the ace, king, and one, in my hand, I had the best hand on the turn, so the king helped, of course, calling the river, but, I mean, if I was calling it excuse me, the turn was a small bet, but in my mind, I was still calling kind of a big bet on the turn, and if I'm calling the bet on the turn, most of the time, I'm going to be calling the river also. So, you know, the king had to bring the flush draw out there on the river, which I wasn't too happy because flush draw was in his range. Thing is, I just kind of felt that in the flop, I think it was either a 10-6-6 or a 10-10-6. You know, most of the time I'm gonna be check back my kind of ace high range type of hand. So when I bet there with my ace king high, I think I disguised my hand pretty well. So when he check raises me, I don't know, I kind of felt I had the best hand a lot of the times. So that's why I just told myself I'm gonna keep just calling with my ace high and try to mix it up, you know, a little bit of pot control, but a little bit that I think I have the best hand. So I just called the flop, and when he bet the turn, I still felt I had the best hand, so that's why I called there. And, you know, even if the king, you know, hadn't fell down, I don't know what would happen depending on his bet, but I think I would have called most of his bet on the river, even though a king, you know, would not have come on the river. I don't know. Again, it was just one of those spots, three-handed. You know that he knows that the Reisner was short stack, so I'm going to be folding it out. So, you know, one of those situations, yeah.
John, I know that you had a big party that Harrah's gave you a full suite with booze and food and all sorts of things after you won this whole thing, and you went, you brought all your friends and family and everybody there. Did Joseph Chong show up there? And if so, did you two have a chance to talk about any of the hands then, or have you since?
Well, he did show up. Yeah, we actually hang out in London during the Poker Stars European Poker Tour in London like a month and a half ago. So you know, it was before the final table. But he's a very cool guy, very very good guy. So we talk a lot. We had a good conversation with my other good buddy Pascal Lefrançois. And, you know, we just had a lot of fun. So coming into the final table, I think we kind of became friends, even though we were playing against each other on the final table. So after that, of course, he was invited to the party. He did show up. We didn't talk too much poker, though. It was just about, having a good time. And I think it was happy for me. Of course, he would have wanted to be at my place, of course. But he's a very good guy. And, I think we're going to have a lot of fun over the upcoming tournaments. But, you know, Joseph, very good guy. And, we basically just had a little glass of champagne and talk about life. Yeah.
All right. Well, I got to follow up on that because he was quoted as saying that he didn't want to win for whatever reason. And we talked about that on our show. In fact, this is now the fourth week in a row that the subject has come up in one way or the other, because we talked about it last week with Chris Moneymaker and 2 weeks ago with John Reisner. The idea of not wanting to win it because of the pressure, the burden that comes with being the world champion, having to do all the press that you've done, etc. And some guys on Poker Road and some other online forums have speculated that that's the reason he made these moves, that he didn't really want to win this thing, that he was just going to be happy with the $4.5 million. Do you buy any of that?
No, I don't. I'm not sure. I really don't. I don't know. Like, I haven't heard that quote from him. It's very tough to believe. I mean, even though, you know, I understand the role of being the poker ambassador and stuff like that. But, I mean, who wouldn't want to win this tournament? I mean, every poker player is want to win this one. I don't know anybody who would say, I want to finish third, I don't want to win. I think it's impossible. Maybe I understand the fact that, you don't want to do that many interviews and stuff like that, and I respect that. But I'm really not sure. I'm sure at all that he doesn't think that, and I'm sure he really wanted to win the tournament. Saying that he played that A7 because of that, I don't think it really agrees to the situation. But I mean, who knows? But anyway,
that's what we think too, right, Dennis?
Yeah, right. There's no way that he doesn't want to win that. Absolutely.
Of course.
There's no way. All right. You brought up a good point, though. I still stay in touch with a lot of guys that I made the final table with. You make some lifelong friends there and everything. And now the table's over and all the play's done. So you sat down with eight other guys. Was there anybody in there that you had such a good read on that you really wanted to get involved in hands with? Was there somebody there that you just wanted to avoid for whatever reason? Either, you know, he seemed to always catch cards against you, or you didn't quite follow his play or his strategy or anything like that. Did you have any kind of ranking on who you wanted to go against or who you'd like to see somebody else take out maybe?
Well, the thing is that on that precise final table, I think like the play was very tough. The players were very good poker players. So in my head, there was no weak spot on the table. So I kind of felt that it's going to be up to me just to make no mistakes. So, you know, as long as I don't make any mistakes, I'm going to be good. But I know that the other guys probably won't make any mistakes either. So, you know, at that point, it's just going to be a very tough game. I had a lot in mind. I mean, Grinder was on my left. He was short in chips. I didn't want him to double up. You never want Grinder with a lot of chips on your left. He doubled up a couple of times. I had position on Dolan and Joseph Chong. John Dolan and Joseph Chong were the two biggest stacks at the beginning. So I said to myself, I'm going to put a lot of pressure on them because they have big stacks and they don't want to get involved with me. Chong four bets me every time. So it was a very tough final table, very, very tough to play against. So for me, it was just about, I'm going to play my cards. I'm just going to play my game, try to cut my spots good, and, you know, try to make no mistakes and just, you know, take it one hand at a time, really. I didn't have any precise strategy against any persons out there. So it was just, I think it was very tough, but it was very, very fun. One of the funniest, like, table I've ever played, that's for sure.
It's the final table with Dennis Phillips and Paul Harris and 2010 main event champion Jonathan Duhamel, who, well, you just mentioned the grinder, so let's talk about him a little bit. You said you didn't want to double him up. You didn't want him to get chips, but at one point he had a lot of chips, and you had slipped from chip leader to fifth. You were the short stack with only five left, and you got into that hand where you had ace-nine, and he had a pair of threes, and he way overshoved to put your tournament life at risk. And it seemed to me, and again, we don't know because we weren't there for the actual live moment, but it seemed to me like you pretty quickly called that ace-nine. Walk us through that hand, if you would.
Yes, I wasn't too happy about that, that's for sure. But the thing is, I think he shoves pretty quickly. He three-bet shoves pretty quickly. And it was kind of an overshove. I think it was 26 big blinds. It was blind versus blind, the hand. And the thing is, when he shoves that fast, in my head, ace-king and ace-queen were not really in that range. So, you know, the hand I was really worried about was more of an ace-jack, ace-ten type of hands. But in my head, he could have, you know, those ace-seven suited or ace-six suited or king-queen kind of hand or a small pair or things like that. So for me, it was just, given the fact that we're blind versus blind, there's kind of, you know, there's money in the middle, a lot of chances I'm flipping, but I could have had the best hand also in my hand. Just, but the thing is also, when I raised from the small blind, you know, at that point I was open raising my small blind maybe, I don't know, 70-75% of the time. So when he shows pretty fast, I kind of just felt that he knew that. He kind of knew I was raising a lot my small blinds there. So I just kind of felt he could even have a kind of a queen eight suited type of hand. So in my head, I wasn't happy about the ace nine. You don't want to put your tournament on the line with that kind of hand. But at the same time, I just kind of felt, you know, I have to make the call. I have to take that gamble, even though I'm not happy with it. So at the end, I just, you know, hesitated for, I don't know how long it took me. But at the end, just felt like, you know, I got to go with it, and I got to take a gamble. And hopefully, you know, maybe I'll have the best hand. Maybe we'll be flipping. And, you know, let's hope to be lucky.
But now, that was hand 150. Hand 149 was when you dropped to fifth place. That's when you had the ace-king versus the ace-queen. It was Reisner, and he spikes a queen on you. So just moments before that, you just, you know, gave away several million chips over to Reisner and dropped all the way to fifth place. The very next hand, you're in the small blind, and somebody shoves on you again. You don't think that had any influence on your calling?
Well, not really, I think, because I think I'm pretty good. One of my strengths, I'm pretty good at, you know, let your emotions, like, aside from, you know, what happened. So in my head, you know, the queen, the hand against Reisner, the queen falls on the flop. So at that point in my head, as soon as I saw the flop, the hand was over for me. So I was already thinking about the next hand, how much chips I have, how much big blinds I have. So, you know, as soon as the hand was over, I already knew, you know, I was already ready to go for the next hand. So in my hand, you know, in my head, when it started, when the hand started, you know, there's threefold, and then it's up to me. I was, you know, the hand was over. I wasn't happy, but I wasn't tilting at all, I think. So it just kind of felt I'm going to be raising a lot of my small blinds there, and he shoved so quickly and overshoved. I really felt like I'm, you know, I don't represent strength that much, but, you know, neither does he. So I think that's why at the end I just ended up making the call.
I agree with the last thing you said there. When he overshoves so quickly, he's not showing a monster hand there, unless he's giving off some double reverse tell. I think you played the final table there very, very well. We already talked about that hand against Grinder and the big one against Joseph. I also thought on the hand where you took him out, where you took Grinder out by just flatting in the small blind with your aces, essentially letting him hang himself with the queen high flop where he had a queen eight. I mean, all the money's going in there because that's the kind of flop. He either wants an eight high flop or a queen high flop, and he got the queen high flop. So all the money's going in. but I thought you trapped him so perfectly there, as you had done a couple of other times in the course of the day. I had a lot of respect for your game, which leads me to a question we've talked about with several other champions before, which is, how are the Railbirds treating you? I mean, are you aware of what your image is online, and when you play online, are they coming after you? Are they being nice to you? How's that going?
Well, most of the people, I would say, are very nice to me. Most of the people are very happy about the result that I had. I think, I don't know, a lot of people, a lot of Canadians are very proud that I'm the first Canadian to win it. You know, as far as I know, people are being, you know, as I said, cool with me, supportive with me. So, I mean, I have nothing to complain about. And, you know, as for the online play, you know, I just played the Canadian Coupe, the Canadian Championship of Online Poker on PokerStars this week. I had a lot of people, you know, watching me. I was chatting with a lot of people. It was very fun to do. And, you know, from what I've seen, people, you know, have been very nice with me.
Okay, real quick question. Now, somebody told me you went out and bought an Audi. And I know you went out and bought season tickets for the hockey. All right, what's number three? What's your next goal? What are you going to go do?
Boy, the Audi was, you know, a couple months. Well, it was like 3 months ago, so it was before the win, actually. So, you know, I just needed a car, so it was a good reason when you know you're going to make the final table, I guess. but I don't know what's next. I mean, for now, the thing I want to do is travel a lot. I want to play all the big tournaments. So, you know, for me, from now on, it's going to be about playing the biggest tournaments in the world. I have a lot of them in mind. You know, I want to be playing the PokerStars European Poker Tour, as well as the PokerStars North American Poker Tour. You know, there's the Asia Pacific Poker Tour, also a lot of big, big tournaments. And what I want to do is just basically I want to go out there and, you know, prove myself and prove to everybody, you know, I kind of deserve that win. And, you know, it was mostly skills, more than luck. So I just want to try to make another big scores, continue to test myself against the best poker players in the world, and, you know, hopefully make another big one.
Yeah. By the way, how many times have you been propositioned by women? I heard there was one woman who walked up to you in a bar and said, let's go to Vegas and get married right now.
Yeah, a couple of them.
All right, before we let you go, John, since our show is sponsored by PokerStars and you and Dennis are both PokerStars-sponsored players, take a moment to promote your PCA promotion that Stars is running with some free rolls right now.
Yeah, of course. It's going to be an amazing tournament there. I know you can play some free roll. You go on to PokerStars.net. You log on that site, and you can play a lot of free rolls. And if you're the lucky one to win it, you're going to have a free trip to the Bahamas. You're going to have dinner with me, some other PokerStars pro also. We're going to have a good time, drink a couple of good bottle of wines, talk about poker, you know, enjoy the Bahamas. So it's going to be a very, very cool trip. Again, this is, you know, this is the second biggest tournament in the world after the World Series. So it's probably going to be over $3 million to the winner again. Very, very, you know, good money, good tournament. I've been there the last 2 years. It was amazing. So, I mean, join us. It's going to be a lot of fun. You go on PokerStars.net and you play for free there. And hopefully we're going to have the chance to meet in the Bahamas.
And Dennis, you'll be there too, right?
Absolutely. I will be there, hopefully there for a long time. I would like nothing more than you and I to match up at a final table. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, that would be very cool, of course.
Well, John, we really appreciate it. We congratulate you. As I said, we have a lot of respect for how you played, and we're looking forward to seeing what you do next and over the course of the next few years. Just don't go Peter Eastgate on us, okay?
I won't. I promise I won't. And thanks a lot for the show. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care.
Jonathan Duhamel, the 2010 World Series of Poker main event champion, joining us here on the final table. I think he is going to be a good ambassador for the game, Dennis.
Absolutely, I do. The guy knows his poker. He knows how he likes to play. He's very articulate, and he's down to earth. He's just going out there, and he's going to do what some people were afraid he wasn't going to do. He is going to stay with poker. He is going to play all the major events. He is going to be out there where everybody can see him.
Let me get some plugs in here for our other sponsor, which, of course, is Harrah's St. Louis. We're in just a couple of minutes when this show is over. We'll start up the what I call the pizza game. It's the 2-5 game with the 500 max buy-in and And then about 6 o'clock, I buy pizza for everybody. We've had a couple of tables starting things off the last couple of weeks, and it looks like we got a long list of people chomping at the bit. In fact, they're walking around this table now, circling it like vultures, ready to claim their spot here and take part in the action. If you would like to follow Dennis Phillips and Jonathan and so many others to the main event in 2011, this is the place to be starting in January, when Harrah's St. Louis will host once again their World Series of Poker main event qualifiers. $200 buy-in. They're going to do it on the third Saturday and Sunday of each month. It is a shootout format, and Dennis can tell you, all you got to do is beat 18 people and you go to the main event.
That's it. It's real simple. You win your first table, sit down with eight other people, and be the last one sitting.
Yep. And we'll have more details on that for you as we get closer to the new year. Next week, we'll be joined by Antonio Esfandiari, a guy who's been an online and an on-TV poker favorite for several years, who I'm sure will have some fantastic stories to tell. In the meantime, for Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas, I'm Paul Harrah's here at Harrah's St. Louis. Thanks for listening to The Final Table on 590 of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com, and our podcast via iTunes and on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com.